A. Boyer, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In order of their appearance, they are 040838 C.L. Westbrook Jr. versus Peggy Lee Finley from Tarrant County and the 2nd Court of Appeals District. Docket number 050132 USAA versus James Stephen Bright from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. And Justice Green is not sitting in that cause. And docket number 050189 Borg Warner Corporation, now known as Burns International Services Corporation, versus Arturo Flores from Nueces County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And Justice O'Neill is not sitting in that cause. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040838 C.L. Westbrook versus Peggy Lee Finley.
May it please the court, Mr. Kelly Shackelford will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has 4 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, plaintiff's remaining claim against Pastor Westbrook should be dismissed. The district court decision dismissing all of plaintiff's claims against her church, her elders, and her pastor was the correct decision. There are two separate issues that people are confronted with whenever they first see this case. The first is their reaction to the doctrine of discipline, which some people disagree. But the second is the judicial issue, the issue that we're here about, and that is who decides church discipline, judges or churches? And I think a crucial point is to understand that to allow lawsuits to proceed against churches and pastors based upon the church's disciplinary actions is no different from banning the religious practice altogether.
Now, the plaintiff would say this is not based on the church's disciplinary actions.
Well, the plaintiffs simply do what, if you look at the number of cases, like the Tran case or the Williams case, a number of Texas cases, they do what happens in all these cases. They simply recast the pleadings by putting separate labels on them. But every Texas case has dealt with it has rejected that.
How much of this is fact-based in determining secular versus pastoral? Let's say that the original relationship had continued. My understanding is you can see that it began as a secular counseling relationship.
Not the allegations which they base their lawsuit on.
No, I understand that. But,
yes.
But I believe you conceded in your brief that at the very beginning, you divided it into two time periods.
Right.
And you say at the first time period it was secular because
right.
She was paying a fee, it was at his office, he was not a pastor at the time. What if that relationship had continued and he had then become a pastor as well? Would your result be the same?
I don't think so. That would probably fall within one of the specific exceptions. And really, it's an excellent question because it goes to sort of the two different approaches that are being offered to the court of how you approach these cases. Plaintiff's approach is that you would actually look at the relationship and the conduct between the pastor and the individual, and you would actually force judges to sift through those facts and determine which facts are religious enough to be religious, which ones are secular, and then there would be a weighing of the religious versus the secular. What we say is that kind of an analysis, the Supreme Court said in at least 7 different cases that kind of analysis is unconstitutional. And it would actually then mean that this would be the first, because the next case would come to you and a fact would be different. And you would have to determine that, and it would go...
No, I understand that, but I guess in terms of the purely secular argument that you're making, if that original... Let's just say this was based on the original relationship that you conceived was secular.
Yes.
And the only difference, in fact, was the secular counseling continued, but he also became a pastor and was a pastor as well. Where would you draw the line there?
Well, the same. You would have... I'll go through our approach as the opposite, which would answer that question. Instead of drawing these lines and entangling the court, we say the lines have already been drawn in this area. And that is that the general rule from Watson on down is that cases which arise out of church discipline, and this case certainly does, you have all the breach and the damages arise out of the church discipline conduct. Those cases are barred jurisdictionally unless it's one of the exceptions. That is an intentional physical tort, purely secular conduct like sexual misconduct or commercial fraud. And if you're outside of those specific exceptions, what the courts have said, Watchtower does this very well at the end of the Watchtower case. It's also in the Tran case and in the Williams case. They say that outside of that, intangible or emotional harm might occur, and there might not be a remedy for it. But we have decided that the damage to the First Amendment and to the courts by dragging them into these internal disputes would be much greater, and therefore that is a harm that we'll forego.
So you would start with the church discipline, and you would say if it arises out of church discipline, it's off limits, then why does it matter if it's purely secular?
Well,
counseling. I mean, in this case, it wouldn't.
Those exceptions would.
If I understand your argument, then.
Yes.
If the cause of action arises out of the church discipline, which is here the publication to the elders according to the plan, then even if she had a purely secular relationship at the beginning, that wouldn't matter because the discipline is the damage in this case.
That's true. It would matter in if it was one of the exceptions, though. What I'm saying is if you're talking about a commercial transaction, you're in the commercial fraud area. I mean, and therefore it would take you out of the normal jurisdictional bar. In this case, what you have is, if you look at, for instance, page 86 and 87 of the reporter's record, you've got plaintiff admitting that there were no fees for this conduct, which is the basis for a lawsuit, and that, in fact, a fee was never discussed. And the reason for that is what this is about is a meeting at the pastor's home with four or five couples from the church, the pastor and his wife, an elder and his wife, and other members of the church. And, of course, a fee was never discussed or brought up because this is the pastor talking about marriage with members of the church.
And so that, when you talk about the record, are we talking about a bill of exceptions or are we talking about evidence that was actually admitted by the trial court for the purpose of making its determination?
We're talking about the bill that they offered below. In this case, we sort of have two. These are all their facts. We have their pleadings and we have the plaintiff who actually went on the stand and offered more jurisdictional facts
as a bill.
And what we're saying is it really doesn't matter whether you just look to the pleadings or whether, as under Miranda it says, you must look to other facts, jurisdictional facts. We're saying it doesn't even really matter because either way you look, they have an incurable problem. And that is the entire breach and the entire damages come out of a pure disciplinary action. And to allow that to go forward is simply to allow the jury to punish the church for its doctrine of discipline.
Let's assume that the letter was never sent to the congregation at all, and that all we're talking about is the disclosure of what the plaintiff calls confidential information from the pastor, to the pastor, his disclosure to other members of the court. So we're not talking about shunning. Does that change your analysis in any way?
Well, I think I would have to know kind of what we're talking about, but I think what Your Honor is saying is they try to go back a step and they try to say, well, we're not saying that the breach was in the disciplinary letter. We're saying the breach was when the pastor communicated with the elders. And what we're saying is that is as pure and core a part of the disciplinary process as the letter. I mean, it's the pastor and the elders talking about whether they should take discipline and then forming the letter that would go to the church to define its doctrine and its discipline.
Well, let's assume all that is fine for the purpose of this argument. At what point does that role stop? What happens when the members leave the congregation because they don't want to be shunned? You know, they want to take whatever dilemmas they have to another church that perhaps is more forgiving.
Right. Your Honor, that's actually a question that came up at the Court of Appeals, and I know Mr. Keith conceded that the law was that distinction is not recognized, and so it wasn't brief, but I'll give you a couple of cases that I think answer that question. The Watchtower case, the Federal Court of Appeals case, the whole case is about shunning, where all of the conduct, the torts that were being brought, was for conduct that happened to them after they were a member, as shunning, of course, would. And the court says it's irrelevant that the person's no longer a member. That church, that entity, has a right to follow its doctrine just as that person has the freedom to leave.
Well, at what point would that harassment stop?
Well, I think in the Watchtower case, they would say, you know, it would go on forever. The shunning will go on forever. As far as being shunned, not communicating with, those type of things, again, the type of intangible or emotional harm type things that would occur. Now, in this case, I would point out that this letter was specifically the last step. It was the last step of Matthew 18. The first step was when the pastor called her when he found out, not through her, that she was on a liaison with another man, begging her to come back. And then the next step was when she landed at the airport and she was brought to the home of the pastor by her husband. There were two or three more. That's the two or three more step. The last step was the letter to the church. And so there would be no more action.
But you say it's beside the point that she resigned before the letter was published.
Yes. It is, and for a number of reasons. Number one, again, I would encourage the if you're looking at cases on this, the Watchtower case, the Bryce case as well, answers that question. And the other thing I would say is, in this case, it's even lesser even of a close call than normal, because in this case, the plaintiff is not only a fellow member, as she states, as they state in their brief, she was a co-founding member with all the defendants that she brought suit against, and therefore agreed to the same doctrine and the same disciplinary process. And the very conduct that was the focus of the disciplinary process was conduct that she engaged in while she was a member.
Is there at any point does the pastor have an obligation in this confession to give a warning that, let me remind you of our church doctrine, that anything you tell to me will be given to the congregation, and then we're going to shun you pursuant to our belief in the Scripture? Or do you, once you become a member of that church, do you forego all any civil rights that you may or may not have?
Well, I think it would be problematic for the courts to come in and sort of tell the pastor what his obligation is, in conversations with members or with regard to his doctrine. Now,
that certainly would be an overstep of the court's
power. Right. And in this case, though, you've got we put attached as exhibits to our brief the who we are, what we believe. It's very clear. Matthew 18 is inconsistent with confidentiality. If you talk one-on-one and you rebuke somebody in their sin, you're required, if they refuse to repent, to go with two or three more. And so that is a biblical belief that many churches have and many churches follow. And again, I think the choice, the sort of paradigm that this court is given, is to take this approach which plaintiffs offer, which requires sifting through facts and entangling the court in all kinds of matters, which I would note, they cite no church discipline cases in their brief. None. We cite a myriad of cases that say that is not the approach. You simply look to the exceptions. And those exceptions are very clearly drawn lines. They're not hard to understand. They don't entangle the court.
Mr. Shepherd, let me ask you this. Just assume these facts and tell me how this applies. Let's say the pastor brings in Ms. Penley and says, look, I'm a licensed professional counselor. You know that I've been licensed by the state of Texas. I'm also a pastor. I'm wanting to get information from you and counsel you in my role, not as pastor, but as a professional licensed counselor. And given that, is there if those were the facts, that I'm not basing my advice on the Bible or on church doctrine, but on my expertise as a professional counselor. That established. Would the facts change at all? Would your analysis change?
I guess one of my questions would: are you saying that she's paying him a fee, and he's saying that since he's offering secular counseling, not free?
Fee or no fee? I don't think that matters. If he's just saying, yes, I'm your pastor, but I don't want to talk to you in my role as pastor. I want to talk to you in my secular role as counselor.
If that's the tougher case of drawing the line.
What would the result be?
I think that if there was no fee, if there was no commercial transaction, that it would therefore not fall within any of the exceptions. And all of the conduct that is going to be punished and all of the damages are going to come out is out of the church disciplinary action. and that that's going to be one of the areas that is barred by the church discipline cases. And again, it's one, that's one of those cases I'm talking about where intangible or emotional harm will occur, and it will go unremedied at times. But the damage on the other side, if every time a pastor did anything for free, he could be challenged as all somebody has to do is put a secular label
on
it.
What I'm saying is not only doing it for free, but specifically telling his client that this is not in my role as a pastor. I'm not bringing religious doctrine in, church doctrine. I just want to talk to you as I'm a professional. I want to talk to you in purely secular terms about this problem.
Yeah, then you would have a situation of mixed secular and religious conduct, like we're talking about.
But he's saying, no, I'm not, no religious conduct.
But I'm distinguishing from the beginning of the relationship and the end, that you have a mixed situation in that. And the exceptions to that, you know, are clear, intentional, physical, toward, purely secular conduct, again, all the way through, like a sexual misconduct or something like that.
But under my facts, the ecclesiastical extension doctrine would apply.
I think it would, absent some sort of payment or something like that. I think it would, because I think the bright line is necessary, or what's going to happen is the church's courts are going to be drug into these situations,
Mr.
and
Shackelford,
all you have to do is plead secular.
If Pastor Westbrook had circulated the letter not just to the members of the church, but to the whole Fort Worth community at large, would the result change, at least to some extent, in your opinion?
Obviously, that's a case way beyond our facts, which is sort of how far, who you can communicate with. All I would say on this is the cases that are out there right now around the country say no, that it would not affect the doctrine. For instance, the Williams case below, Williams versus Gleason. One of the arguments in that case, one of the claims that was brought, was that not only did the church discipline go on, but the elder sent a letter to an outside ministry about what had happened in the church discipline. And yet the court, when they analyzed it, they said, the only question for us is the underlying conduct that is arising out of church discipline? If it is, we have no jurisdiction. And we have to back off.
Well, I understand your argument to be based on this point on Matthew 18. And Matthew 18 discusses not just communicating the problem to two or three so that there are two or three witnesses, but then going to the church.
Yes.
Communicating outside of the church is also, therefore, outside of Matthew 18. Now, you think that situation would still be covered by church autonomy doctrine?
What I'm saying is the cases that I see would say yes.
I'm familiar with the cases. I want to know your opinion.
I think so. And the rationale is what we tend to think of when we think of church discipline is this is all about the church trying to bring this person back. And that's one factor, but that is not the biggest factor from the court standpoint. The reason that Watson versus Jones has those three categories of non-jurisdiction, doctrine, the picking of leaders and training of leaders of the church, and church discipline, is those three items are how the church defines itself. That is the very core, and therefore, to simply, for the church to speak, it's speaking to the whole church about what they believe and what they stand for.
Justice Heck, did you want to ask?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Darrell Keith will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Keith, while you're getting ready there, does the record indicate when Mrs. Penley was in Tennessee?
Yes, Your Honor. She was in Tennessee in either late September, early October in that 2000. Your Honor.
So the disclosure of the relationship to Pastor Westbrook was made while he was a pastor. That is, in that second phase of the relationship when he became pastor of the church and she was a member of the church, not during the 1998 time period when he was functioning purely as a professional counselor.
Well, I would answer that that is partially true, Your Honor. Our position is that there were three relationships: friendship, counseling, professional secular counseling, and then pastoral. And Penley maintains in her pleadings and in her bill of exception testimony that she regarded that the counseling relationship is ongoing. The initial counseling was secular, in an office outside of the church, not connected with any church activity for which she paid a fee.
Yeah, there's been.
And then it was reinstated, and she considered that relationship continued when Westbrook suggested in the fall of 2000 that she go into counseling because she believed at that time that her marriage was dead.
There's been a lot of discussion about fees. What significance is that, if any? Because certainly a pastor in most congregations gets paid by the congregation. So what difference does it make if he's getting paid to minister gospel, minister the Bible, versus wearing some other type of secular hat, when, as you say, there are three different type of relationships?
Yes. Justice Medina, in the wide body of professional liability law, duties arise from various professional client, patient, and other types of relationships. And as a general proposition, the payment of a fee along with the acceptance of the person as a client or patient, if you will, in the medical or counseling context, is some evidence of the existence of the relationship and the duty of ordinary and reasonable care
that
the professional owes.
I understand that. What happens when you tithe? I mean, do you create a different relationship with the pastor? Does it all remain in a religious congregational context? Especially in a situation when you have someone as...
I believe our position is those are separate. We believe that this is not a case that is an affront, an abridgment of religious liberties, but rather is a case involving professional secular counseling negligence arising from Mrs. Penley's counseling, secular counseling relationship with Westbrook, and not pastoral.
Do you agree that if this were a defamation claim, that it would be protected by the First Amendment religious clauses?
No, we actually asserted a defamation claim early on, but for strategic reasons, we dropped that claim.
Well, strategic, but because it probably would be swept out by the First Amendment, wouldn't it?
I was certainly concerned about First Amendment issues.
Well, sir,
Your Honor,
you should then have to
Mr.
dig into the truth. And to get to the truth, you'd have to get to the basis of the biblical discipline process, and the cases seem to have held that crosses the line. Why should, if it's defamation, it's off limits? When it changes to a negligence claim, it should not be off limits as well.
Well, without conceding I granted that there are many cases that are troublesome for Ms. Penley. We did drop that claim. It's not before the court. Our position with regard to the professional negligence claim is that from the time that Ms. Penley formed a secular counseling relationship with Mr. Westbrook up until the time of the ill-fated meeting in which she returned from Tennessee at his urging, and she disclosed to him that she had a relationship with Mr. Penley, to whom she was not married, while she was still married to Stone, that all of that was in the context of her secular counseling relationship.
No, I understand that argument. But we talk a lot about the nature of the relationship, but I understand the argument to be that if the damages arise from the ecclesiastical act, that really we're dancing on the head of a pin in terms of trying to parse the secular versus pastoral counseling piece. And that's the analogy I'm making is to defamation, because in defamation it's the publication where the damage arises. And if that is core ecclesiastical activity, why doesn't that same construct apply here?
That is an excellent question, a very important question, and I believe that the best answer And the most important answer is that Ms. Penley's claim does not depend, it is not based solely upon the publication of the letter. Ms. Penley's claim is based upon the negligence allegation against Pastor, against, you know, counselor slash Pastor Westbrook in his counseling role, in the services he rendered, the counseling he rendered, the decision that he made in prodding her to give out confidential information that was embarrassing to her about her relationship with Mr. Penley without warning her that he was then going to use it in a religious context and then disclosing confidential information in his secular role to the religious officials, to the church elders, who then ultimately sent the letter.
The current live petition is the second amended petition.
Yes, sir. Right.
And it seems, reading that, the only specific wrongful conduct alleged is the publication of the letter.
Well, our pleadings are broader than that. As the Court of Appeals acknowledged, we asserted a longstanding relationship. We asserted that there was negligence in providing the proper services and adequate services and counseling. And I'm just pointing out that in the record, in the bill of review record, testimony of Ms. Penley, she testified that Westbrook made an admission in that last meeting in October that he had, quote, dropped the ball in his counseling and hadn't pursued more counseling with her husband to try to save the marriage. In addition, she testified that at one point in time he had urged her to continue the counseling when she was telling him the marriage was dead and she wanted out. And he told her, well, it wouldn't be necessarily good for the marriage, but it would be good for the children. He has an obvious conflict of interest. He's wearing three hats in his relationships with her, and in the counseling context, he's wearing his professional counseling hat, for which he was licensed by the great state of Texas to provide that counseling. That was the origins of their relationship, and she testified that it was continuing. The important thing, I think, is that in the court below, Westbrook took the position, it was unclear in the hearing, but at the end of the hearing, his counsel took the position that they were taking as true the plaintiff's pleadings. And the plaintiff's pleadings focus solely upon the secular relationship, and we broadly plead the entirety of that relationship. I'm giving you some of the examples in her testimony that would form the basis of her claims and for mental anguish and damages that she suffered even before the letter was ever published.
Mr. Keith, you've explained a number of facts and information and testimony. The question, as I understood it, was whether you pled a different claim, this disclosure of confidentiality. Certainly you're not suggesting that anything in Miranda says that you can pursue claims that aren't pled. You're not suggesting that.
Of course not, Your Honor.
So your position is what you said in the petition, second amended petition, is broad enough to cover these things.
Yes, Your Honor. It's reasonably inferable that the release of confidential information without Ms. Penley's authority is part of our claim, but our pleadings are also broad enough to encompass the entirety of his counseling services, and I have pointed out with specificity the testimony that Ms. Penley gave that would underscore to support those types of claims.
That was never admitted. Is that correct?
It was not admitted, but Westbrook, in the course of this appeal, keeps walking back and forth between the pleadings and the bill.
Is that evidence that really a court can consider? It was not admitted in evidence. Is it really before us?
I think that if it appears to me strongly arguable that Westbrook is trying to have it both ways. He wants to use the bill of exception testimony when it is favorable and avoid it when it is not, and he goes back and forth between the pleadings. As Mr. Shackelford indicated, he felt that the two were intertwined and it was authorized under Miranda. And it seems to me that what has occurred is that Westbrook is basically raising jurisdictional fact issues that weren't you know, readily apparent before the trial court, but appeared to be raised on appeal, and I think that that's what we're engaged in.
I have one other question just on the record, and that is I seem to recall that there was a communication to Ms. Penley from the church that that this doctrine applied, that if there were this sort of relationship, she's at risk of it having it be exposed among the church congregation, a letter or a policy or something like that. Is that correct?
Well, Ms. Penley signed papers agreeing to follow the Constitution, bylaws, and the statement of the mission of the church. And that would include her submission to the disciplinary process of the church. With regard to Your Honor's question about whether there was some communication before that, our pleadings, again, take the position that in the course of her secular counsel relationship with Westbrook, that she was not made aware. I mean, we plead a totally secular cause of action
well,
in her testimony.
My question is that her signature agreeing to abide by the disciplinary process, does that bring this whole case within the ecclesiastical exception?
I do not believe so, because she was involved in a secular counseling relationship with Westbrook throughout, and that's in our pleadings, and that's buttressed by her testimony. She's adamant about that. When she was called back to his home, if the court considers that evidence, she was not led to believe. Her testimony was she thought she was coming back to a group, secular group, marital counseling session.
Let me ask you two questions, right?
And not a religious
situation. I want to ask you two questions because we've got a very lively bench, and I want answers to these, please. There's been reference as to whether or not she signed a letter and whether or not that's even significant. As Mr. Shackelford stated in his argument, she was a co-founder of this organization. Her at that status, does that create a difference as to whether or not she's a co-founder, whether or not she's just a regular member of the congregation, or whether or not she's a deacon or an elder? What difference, if any, does that make? And the fact that what if Mr. Westbrook is not licensed in anything else other than pastoring a congregation? What significance, if any, would that make?
I think her co-founder status is not relevant or important to deciding the issue of this case.
But certainly that gives her notice of what more than I would think the average.
She certainly is familiar with the Constitution, the bylaws, and their disciplinary proceedings, but her case is that she was seeking marital counseling, and her relationship with Mr. Westbrook, which started out as a friend when they were co-members of the preceding church from which they left and formed the new church.
But the question is not standard of care, focusing on what's the standard of care. If you've agreed in advance that the deal is if I cross the line in various areas, that's just going to be published to the church if I don't change, if I don't repent. And if that can be, if this could all have been published to the church, regardless of what she told somebody in counseling, how is she damaged because it came from counseling rather than from her husband?
Well, her marriage perhaps could have been saved through proper counseling or with proper counseling.
This court is not going to get into the business and deciding what's the best way to save the marriage. That's what churches do. That's what the legislature does. The question is, if she assented to the damage in the first place, before she ever did anything, how can she be damaged because that damage she assented to, the process she assented to, the harm she assented to, came from a source she did not expect?
Because Westbrook had a duty at common law of this state and by statute in the state as a licensed professional counselor to provide services to her in accordance with ordinary and reasonable prudence under the same or similar circumstances. And from the time of his initial counseling until the time of the last meeting, over that period of time, we contend there was negligent counseling on his part that caused or contributed to cause to the marital problem and her mental anguish and other damages before the letter was ever published.
Didn't she agree by joining a church? I mean, Matthew 18 has been around a long time. And you join a church with Matthew 18, whether you're a co-founder or sitting on the back row, that's the deal. If they say this is this kind of church, and if you do this kind of behavior, we're going to tell everybody in here about it. And if you join under those circumstances, how then do you sue anybody because what you agreed to explicitly actually happens?
Well, Justice Brewster, I think that she has a right to bring an action against Westbrook because he wasn't wearing his pastoral hat during the times of these communications and relationships. She believed that she was talking to him in a confidential setting as her marital counselor and not as her pastor, and she didn't believe she was at risk that he would take that information, disseminate it. In fact, according to her testimony, he indicated to her that he wouldn't cause her any harm.
Well, let me ask you this. My understanding is that the counseling that she, where you claim that the breach of confidence occurred, or that where this information was given, was during group counseling through a church group. Is that right? At his home. So under your theory, every couple who participated in that was undergoing pastoral counseling, but for her, who years before had had secular counseling. I mean, it was in a group session through the church with her pastor. Right?
No, it was not pastoral counseling. It is our position that Westbrook moved his secular profession. Keep in mind, I was not allowed to conduct any discovery, not depositions,
no, I understand, but before
nor
we
to cross-examine Westbrook
sure
at the evidentiary hearing.
That there were, it was group counseling from which this arose, and that everyone else in that group was undergoing pastoral counseling.
No. It is our position in our pleadings, at least inferentially, and certainly in her testimony in the bill, that Westbrook moved his secular professional counseling practice from an office in a strip shopping center to his home. And that after that, and that that counseling was not terribly successful, the marriage still deteriorated, she didn't benefit from it. And then after she had a flare-up with her husband and was very distraught, Westbrook suggested group marital counseling session with other people who were members of the church but were having marital problems, and they were conducting group secular professional counseling sessions.
Were
our position.
Were those other people shunned as well?
I do not believe they were the subject of the letter. There may have been, and I apologize, Your Honor, I don't recall if any of the individuals who were in the group session were authors or co-authors of the letter.
Was there any allegation in the underlying case that she was perhaps targeted for some unknown reason as opposed to the pastor of strictly following their belief in Matthew 18?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
I want to know, you said there was no other group or no other individual that was shunned as Ms. Penley was. Is there any indication that there was some type of retaliation against Ms. Penley for any reason other outside of the context of Matthew 18?
Not in part of anyone other than perhaps Westbrook. If I had been allowed discovery, and if I'm allowed discovery in this case, that is, we believe one theory is that his conduct was retaliatory and he misused his secular counseling position to impart information to the religious leaders of the church for reasons apart from religious bases.
Mr. Keith, you called it, quote, group secular counseling, unquote.
Yes, it was group marital counseling.
There were all church members who participated, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
The content of that counseling, was that purely secular in content and topics, and was there a discussion of religious beliefs and tenets?
According to the record as it is now, which is largely the bill, no, there was no biblical or no biblical references, biblical teachings, preaching from the Bible, or Christian concepts specifically addressed. Of course, the Fifth Circuit in the Sanders case, which I have briefed and argued to this court, points out that even if there were biblical or Christian conceptual references in a counseling session where you might have a mixture of pastoral and secular, and here we're saying it was not mixed, that's Westbrook's position, but we're claiming it's not mixed, that is not determinative, and that does raise a fact issue for the jury to consider based upon proper instructions from the trial court.
Well, but
the converse
is true as well. Even if biblical references aren't made during the counseling, that doesn't make it non-pastoral, the cases say. And that works both ways. My understanding is the cases eschew getting away from that sort of analysis altogether because that gets you into what happens in the counseling and can infringe upon the process?
The presence or absence of the biblical references and teaching of Christian concepts are just, they're not conclusive evidence, but they are some evidence for the jury to take into consideration in deciding, or the court if necessary, in deciding the question of the nature of the relationship, where you have a pastor who happens to be a professional counselor as well.
Any further questions?
Chief, if I may ask one. Mr. Keith, is it your position, for example, that the trial court, if we determine that this discipline damage is out, if that should be the determination, is it your position that there is damage in the secular counseling that caused her mental anguish and that the trial court could restrict somehow that?
Yes.
So that you would only be allowed discovery on that, the internal counseling that somehow affected her?
Yes.
Okay, aside and apart from the disclosure or any way involving the church?
Yes, yes, Justice Johnson, that is our position.
Justice Wainwright.
What is your opinion, Mr. Keith, on whether Pastor Westbrook would have breached his obligation to the congregation if upon coming into knowledge of some matter that should be disciplined under Matthew 18, that he didn't follow Matthew 18? Do you believe he would have violated his obligation to the church if he had not pursued or continued under Matthew 18 as pastor?
In the context of the penalty facts, Your Honor?
Yes, this case.
I think that underscores his negligence in not addressing his conflict of interest. If he really believes, and I haven't had a chance to cross-examine him, but if he really believes that he was wearing two hats at the same time, that he was counseling and prodding Peggy Penley to disclose her relationship and intended to use it, then I think that if he had that conflict, then he violated his duty to Peggy Penley, and fulfilling his duty to the church, that's a matter that then gets into church and ecclesiastical matters. And I think the church could seek to discipline him within the church law structure, but I don't think it's a violation of a civil law duty to which the courts could be turned to for relief at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Keith. If there are no further questions, we're ready for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May we please report, Mr. Hiram Sasser will present a rebuttal for the petitioner.
Mr. Sasser, quick procedural question. The Chief Justice asked Mr. Keith whether the hearing testimony was properly before us. Was it admitted, and is it before this court? What's your take on that?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer is it doesn't really matter whether that is before the court or not. Because what's really going on here is that all the damages and the breach arise out of the church disciplinary process.
Now, what about the argument that my understanding is that they're claiming damage separate and apart from the publication to the elders. Is that an area that needs to be carved out, subject to special exception? I mean, it wasn't general just negligence beyond or separate and apart from publication. Can we decide that here if, in fact, it's alleged, or must that go back for special exceptions?
No, Your Honor, there's no need to remand or to send this back for special exception. The reason why is that the entire breach, the entire damages have arisen out of the disciplinary process. When we pushed on that issue to say, well, it was the letter, the only pushback that we got it from their brief, and I believe it was on page 26 of their brief, the only pushback that we got was, oh, no, no, it also arose out of the communication from the pastor to the elders. So in a sense, his fallback position was, well, we can adjudicate this case because we can look at a communication between the voice of the church, the pastor, and the leadership of the church, the elders, all within an internal church communication involving a church disciplinary process. If there was ever a case that called out for the abstention doctrine, this is that case, because when we pushed on where are these damages coming from, that was the only fallback position.
Mr. Sasser, footnote 10 of your brief, you say, of course, strict scrutiny applies. What does that mean in this context? I don't understand what strict scrutiny means in this context.
Well, Your Honor, the truth is that it should have said the strictest scrutiny applies.
Well, I don't understand that either.
Well, Your Honor, what that means is that this is an area, a core area of religious freedom that is so sacrosanct that it's a jurisdictional.
Well, but what are we supposed to scrutinize?
Well, Your Honor, what you're scrutinizing is you're asking, is this situation from beginning to end purely secular?
Well, let the courts get involved, as I understand, in many issues involving religious doctrine, including blood transfusions to some extent, if it involves a minor, services that perhaps use snakes during their worship, congregations that believe it's okay to use some type of form of drug to expand their mind and study of religion. Courts get involved in those type of cases, all which maybe could cause harm to its congregation. Why can't the court get involved in a case where it involves an alleged mental anguish type of claim, or defamation type of claim?
Well, Your Honor, there is a distinct difference between an intentional physical tort and a tort that gives rise to merely emotional damages.
To use snakes, perhaps, in the congregation. It's not the intent for somebody to get hurt. It's the intent that if you have a great belief, you'll be protected.
Well, Your Honor, when someone joins the church, they're joining the belief system of that church. Now, we may look at those belief systems and say, well, we don't agree with those, or we don't like those beliefs, or those are not mainstream.
But where's the line drawn, though? I mean, this is, in my view, the same type of action. Where did the courts draw the line?
Well, the courts draw the line and say that we're not going to get involved in cases that arise out of church discipline. We're not going to get involved in these sort of, the following of Matthew 18 or the following of church doctrine. We're going to abstain from those things because otherwise the court's engaging in this searching case-by-case analysis, which is clearly prohibited.
Mr. Sasser, according to your analysis, if Pastor Westbrook had simply been a fellow parishioner counseling her, marital counselor, and he learned of this, her situation, and he went to the church and said, I've learned of this situation. We're in church next to each other. I need to do something about it. And he goes to her, and she doesn't repent. So he goes to two or three, and they go to her, and she won't accept him just as this situation. In that circumstance, can the courts get involved in her claim that he improperly disclosed?
Well, I think one of the facts that we would need to know is this going to be like a commercial fraud type case?
No, we've got the exact same situation that we have here. He's just a fellow parishioner sitting next to her in the church pew. He learns about it in a secular. She's paying him for counseling. He finds out about it, goes into church. He's sitting next to her and realizes, now we've got a disciplinary problem that I know about. He feels an obligation under his church disciplinary rules to go to her. She says, I'm not going to pay attention to you, just like in this. He gets two or three, and they go to her. She won't hear him, just like this. All we have is not a pastor, but rather a fellow parishioner, and he feels that the disciplinary process requires him to do that. Can this court get involved in those circumstances, or is she out on the pleadings on a jurisdictional matter, as we are here? What would be your position on that?
Well, under those facts, Your Honor, what we're talking about is a commercial relationship. And that's going to be treated differently. The problem here is we have to draw these clean and clear lines.
Because that's what I'm trying to do, clean and clear. Are they out on the pleadings on jurisdiction if Pastor Westbrook is only a fellow parishioner? Is she out, or does she get to pursue the claim?
If all the damages and the causation all arise out of the church disciplinary process, then I believe that would be protected, unless he made some other arrangement with her that it would be strictly confidential. Thank you.
Further questions?
One more real quick, Chief. Talk about the relevance, if any, of Employment Division v. Smith and whether it can ever displace church autonomy in a case like this.
Well, Your Honor, there are at least four different circuits that have addressed this issue. We've all agreed, the Tenth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, Fourth Circuit, all agreed that Smith did nothing to alter the autonomy doctrine. It is as it was in 1871, today as it was then.
Justice Wainwright.
There's a school of thought that the term ecclesiastical abstention is may not be the best term, that it suggests that the courts have jurisdiction but should abstain in certain cases. That school of thought also suggests that church autonomy is a better label to consider these type of disputes under. What do you think?
Your Honor, I think church autonomy is a better label. I know we use abstention doctrine, but after having some discussions with some academic scholars in this area that are much more intelligent than I am, the church autonomy doctrine, I believe, is the appropriate label that the court should use to be consistent for the jurisprudence of the state.
All right, wait. Did you say that right? Or should ecclesiastical abstention after talking to scholars be the proper one?
No, Your Honor, the church autonomy,
yeah, okay.
Church autonomy
right,
label should be the proper label. That would be the proper label.
Thank you, Mr. Satcher. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.